This is American Black Poetry, a voice for all of us. My name is Paul Olson, and I'm going to start. I've had permission to do this. That you have a poet among you, that probably few of you knew that, and it's Verlon Brown. And he shared them with me in this book, and I'm going to, in turn, share three of them with you. It's not fair to listen to Verlon the whole time. We have to get to Nikki Giovanni and Langston Hughes and Richard Wright, or I would just read all of his stuff. Seconds. And when I let you in again, you'll make me smile when I'd much rather frown. You'll sit in my favorite chair, sip my fears, and feed me dreams of once again. You'll wipe the musty smell of loneliness from my room, paint my walls in anticipation, and set little pots of hope across my windowsills. And then you'll ask the sun to shine in on us all over again in hope of something you call forgiveness. Here we go. Me and love are just friends. You're just passing through this time again, as you've done so many times before. Why don't you make up your mind next time, my friend, before you grace my door? And before you slip beneath what is me this time, my friend, unless you plan to stay, don't let me step in time again to your part-time serenades. This is Michael Roberts. Michael Roberts died today. I always knew he would, but in a delicate way and not like this. Against the streets where we once played and laughed and fought and other things less talked about. I read that one twice. Michael Roberts died today. I always knew he would, but in a delicate way and not like this. Against the streets where we once played and laughed and fought and other things less talked about. Thanks for letting us share those. Give him a hand. That's great stuff. Well, what I thought we'd do is I hand out some poems, first of all. And we might have to go every other one. Let's just start out, everybody take one, and then see how we come out. I'll start those going this way, and start these going on the back, going this way. Here's the plan, is to, I'm just going to read some poems that are nice and a part of the American Black experience in ways that we might be surprised. And then I'd like to have us just kind of consider what poetry is. So I just read three good poems. I'm going to read another one, and maybe two. And then together we can just kind of say, well, what does poetry do to us? I'm not looking for that kind of academic answer that you might write in a poetry course. Not in my course you wouldn't, but in some courses they ask that kind of stuff. And just see what poetry does. Then I'd like to, I picked these words myself just for the expedience of the class, have us comment on what you can remember that Jesus said about these things, success, money, health, and so on. And then I'm going to go to some very radical black poetry and suggest to you that it really is true to the gospel about, and it correlates with things that Jesus has told us. And we'll see that as we go. So that's the plan. And everybody, the first ones I'm going to read are not on those handout sheets. Does everybody have two? Do we have enough to go around?
No.
Okay, then just kind of, the white is just, either one. If you have two, like the white one, because I'm not, some of you have, both of them are yellow and they're on both sides. I'm not going to get to all of those poems, so. Well, whatever you have. If you have two sheets and you don't, if you have access to two sheets, you're going to be okay, okay? In this poem, and the power of poetry, is images. The power of poetry is the pictures that they create and what those pictures evoke in us. So this one little tight compact image or picture is going to evoke much more than just those words really are, and what they are on the page. It's going to evoke smells and sounds and memories and all kinds of associations. Sometimes those images have a direct relationship to something else, and then in literary circles they're called allusions. They allude to something very directly. But lots of times they don't, and they just evoke other kinds of very personal feelings. Well, in this first poem I'm going to read, it's called Lenox Avenue Mural. You may have heard of it. It's a pretty famous poem by Langston Hughes. It's not the title, but it's often referred to that as a Dream Deferred. And the Dream Deferred images that he first, so much for that one, that he first talks about is a raisin in the sun. Anybody heard that phrase any other context by any chance? Yeah, it's a play by Lorraine Hansberry. The other image, or another, is a festering sore. Another one is the smell of rotten meat. Another image is that this dream can crust and sugar over. This one isn't very good either. And then this dream can be a sad. Holy cow. There we go. A sagging load. Hikers can identify with a sag. I could anyway the other day. Sagging load. 2 years ago, I went on a hike went back to Donkey Lake with Rudy, and my older son had a pretty heavy pack, and I had a tent. I mean, it's not that big, and it's only a 3-mile hike, but probably a pack that weighed 40 pounds, and my son got sick. So I had to carry his pack in front, my pack in back. Who cares? But I just wanted to know, I know what a sagging load is.
I thought you were going to carry him, too.
Yeah, I thought of that, too. But I just encouraged him. You're going to do it fine. You're going to make it. When you get there, you're going to feel better. And the last image is a bomb explosion. Those general images Langston Hughes applies to the American black experience, most especially in the context of this poem, of what it's like for the southern black to move north. And there's a whole migration that occurs really just before World War I, where literally 7 million blacks moved from the south to the north. And it's an incredible shift of population. It has all kinds of effects socially and economically on the north and on the cities. And this is part of that context, but you'll get it because the images, I think, speak for themselves. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Good morning. Good morning, Daddy. I was born here, he said. Watched Harlem grow until colored folks spread from river to river across the middle of Manhattan, out of Penn Station. Dark tenth of a nation, planes from Puerto Rico and holds of boats, Chico up from Cuba, Haiti, Jamaica, in buses marked New York, from Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, to Harlem, Brooklyn, the Bronx, but most of all, to Harlem, dusky sash across Manhattan. I've seen them come dark, wondering, wide-eyed, dreaming, out of Penn Station. But the trains are late, the gates open, but there are bars at each gate. What happens to a dream deferred? Daddy, ain't you heard? I said to my baby, baby, take it slow. I can't, she said, I can't, I got to go. There's a certain amount of traveling in a dream deferred. Lulu said to Leonard, I want a diamond ring. Leonard said to Lulu, you won't get a damn thing. A certain amount of nothing in the dream deferred. Daddy, 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 all I want is you. You can have me, baby, but my loving days is through. A certain amount of impotence in a dream deferred. Three parties on my party line, but that third party, Lord, ain't mine. There's liable to be confusion in a dream deferred. From river to river, uptown and down, there's liable to be confusion when a dream gets kicked around. You talk like they don't kick dreams around downtown. I expect they do, but I'm talking about Harlem to you. Letter. Dear Mama, time I pay rent and get my food and laundry, I don't have much left. But here is $5 for you to show you I still appreciate you. My girlfriend send her love and say she hopes to lay eyes on you sometime in life. Mama, it has been raining cats and dogs up here. Well, that is all, so I will close. Your son, baby, respectable as ever, Joe. Island. Between two rivers north of the park, like darker rivers, the streets are dark. Black and white, gold and brown, chocolate custard pie of a town. Dream within a dream, our dream deferred. Good morning, Daddy. Ain't you heard? Any part of that, it's a tough one now because you just read quite a bit. Any part of that that you remember? This is not a test. This is a sense about what we're sensitive to, what we remember, what we feel. Any one of those images. Where'd I hear it? Eric, okay, Eric.
Whatever the dream is, kicking the dream around downtown.
That's the image right away. Kicking the dream. It's abused, it's roughly treated, and that image, whatever the dream is, it's kicked around. Great. Anybody else?
Disappointment.
Daddy, ain't you heard? Every time, something. And it's all kinds of things, whether it's travel and moving on, I can't get this job. Good. Anything else?
The impotence.
And what do you feel about that?
Powerless.
Powerlessness. So it's not just, and that's what images do. And what words can do in poetry too. It's not just, skin my knee again here. It's not just the word itself, an impetus that has sexual connotation, baby, baby, you have me. It's powerlessness. And that one word moves out into a whole context of experience. Very good. Anything else?
Well, the whole sense of hopelessness that just overlays the whole thing.
Yeah. It's there, isn't it?
But there's also all the use of familial terms.
Yep. Family is there. So in the face of this hopelessness, what does that family stuff do? I'll come back to that question, but go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, potential for just absolute chaos when you hear, or does it explode?
Yeah.
That all this is going to come out in the most violent, awful, disturbing ways imaginable.
Here's a poem written probably, I'm guessing, 1924, somewhere in the 20s anyway. And he's a prophet, isn't he? All poets are. Does it explode? Well, it did in 1962 and 63 and 64 and Watts and Chicago and Newark and Detroit, and it exploded. Yeah, very good.
But along with that, there's kind of an image of acceptance, too, of the way things are.
Where do you get that from? Where do you get that feeling?
I don't know. I don't know which line, but it's...
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
That's a good answer. It's better than giving the line because...
Well, deferred means that you just put it off.
Yeah.
So the dream is probably still alive.
Yeah. Good. And both of those statements say something about the effect of a poem. If we can ever just pick, this line does this. Poetry for sure, math people, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Always. And that has to do with emotion that gets past the intellect.
Well, the ain't you heard is out there, don't you know that?
Yeah. And especially in the historical context, we're talking millions of people have moved up from the South. Why? That's where the jobs are. World War I is coming, and the one workforce is out, and the black workforce from the South can move in and take all those spots, and then historically what goes on? Then the soldiers come back, black and white, and the black can't get jobs, and the white take the jobs that blacks had, and that's just, ain't you heard? Deferred again. And it's more prophecy of all that. Good. What about that one point? I'll just read this part again. And it's not fair because it's kind of my favorite part of the poem. Dear Mama, time I pay rent and get my food and laundry, I don't have much left. But here's $5 for you to show you I still appreciate you. My girlfriend send her love and say she hopes to lay eyes on you sometime in life. Mama, it has been raining cats and dogs up here. Well, that is all, so I will close. Your son, baby, respectable as ever, Joe. Don't explain it. What?
In that respectable as ever, that's heavy with something.
Okay, it is. Dear Mama, I haven't, still hanging on to your value. Good. Just the feelings you get from that. Poetry, if it doesn't do this first, it isn't going to work. That's why I read Verlaine's. It does. Evokes feeling. And once it strikes our emotion, like, let's say, think something we all see, Dallas, you know, a crummy TV program. It gets our emotions, but there it stops. You know, we're mad at JR. You know, we're mad at some of these characters, and that's emotional, but it doesn't go any further because it isn't deep enough. And you have to have a better TV program than Dallas is to get us into it past just an emotional response. Yeah, kind of the, oh, it's, I can remember when my kids were real little, I used to recite this poem to them, and you all have done it. Hi, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon, right? A little dog. You ever think about that poem? Just, I'm going to step aside for a second and have you do that. Listen to it carefully. Hi, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle. Get the images in mind as we go. Hi, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle. The cow jumped over the moon. The little dog laughed to see such a sport, and the dish ran away with a spoon. What does that say? And you start adding up those images. The dish ran away, the cow jumped. They are unconnected. Now, there's 16th century satire in that, and if you were a scholar of that, I'm not. You'd know some of that. But we don't have that background. We just have the poem as it is. And it's straight, oh, it's not, read it again, Dad. But they don't say it to me anymore. Because it doesn't go far enough into the spirit and the complexity of human existence. Great poetry has to do that.
Wes says it was icy fingers.
Wes is everywhere. Okay, that poem doesn't work. Dallas doesn't work. But then we have these feelings evoked that take us past that. Mama, mama, dear mama. What do you make of the line, mamas, my girlfriend hopes to see you sometime in life? What do you feel?
Lonely.
Separateness, yeah. Pulled right up out of this whole culture of the South. And you can just, you don't have to know that stuff. You can just, I mean, you don't have to know, you just feel it, don't you? This guy's separated. He's lost something of those roots. What else? But something isn't lost. Here's, he's sending in the mail. What's he sending?
Money.
$5. Shows I still appreciate you. We've got, and so the dream deferred that seems so oppressive and so defeating. Here's $5, Mama. I still love you. Or I appreciate you. He didn't say love. He's a man. He can't say that. I mean, he can't, you know, but that's all kind of subtle. But it's clear, isn't it? Do all those, am I wrong? Aren't those feelings all evoked?
There's something real strong that evokes in me about sending money home to Mama.
Yes.
I mean, I grew up with that, and my parents did it, and their parents did it, and I did it, about leaving home and then sending money.
Yeah. Terrific. I'm glad you shared it. What connectedness. What a gesture of love and of I'm away, but... And Mom, is Mom having a hard time back home, maybe? Okay, you get that. All those kinds of feelings sure get evoked. Well, one more. Maybe I won't do this one. How many people were at the Pilgrimage of Poets on Monday night? Okay, I don't think I will do this. I was just going to do that between the world and me, and one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon that about the lynching.
Could I ask a question?
Of course.
I was entranced with your reading to that, where you said, before you were a black person, so you were a white person reading a black person's poem, and then you said the one time you were addressing a group of black people and you mentally shifted. Could you describe that just, you know, briefly?
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at the poem, and I'll do both two things at the same time. Between the World and Me, you have that one by Richard Wright. It's on the right hand. Well, I don't know where I Xeroxed these and cut them around, and I don't know where it is. Between the World, find it. what I said, this is a poem I have memorized, but it's interesting, though, that I don't think I could do it memorized here. I think I'd screw up. Anyway, I have this memorized, and I think as one memorizes poetry, I would challenge you to do that. And if you don't have a poem that's your favorite to memorize, memorize that favorite passage from the Bible. You will be a changed woman, a changed man. by the memorization, somehow then it's a part of you in a way that it never was. And if you don't like poetry and you don't like the stuff that's in the Bible, read Chief Seattle's speech and memorize. Just find something that really is meaningful to you, and it'll be meaningful to you in a way that it never has been before. Well, that's part of this introduction. Then, you become, as you memorize this stuff, the persona of the poem, the speaker of the poem, but not only the speaker, but all that the poem's about. You kind of become that. I can't explain it any better than that, other than to give you that assignment. Do it. You know, and then you'll see what I mean. But to become that, well, I had always, Richard Wright, of course, is black, and he, in my imagination, was out there walking in the woods, and one morning I stumbled suddenly upon the thing, and there's the remains of this lynching. And we'll look at the images in a second. And all these images he sees, and then suddenly the images just are absorbed into his body, and that lynching that occurred last night, last week, whenever, suddenly is now, and it's happening to him. Well, this is the answer to your question now. I had always been the Richard Wright, the poet, and I just kind of, I don't mean to be presumptuous, I'd kind of been this black man stumbling upon, and then that night when the audience was largely black, I was a white man stumbling upon this lynching. And the experience was very different and mindful that we are all, and since I'm a man I'll use this phrase, we are all brothers. And that the lines, the dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. Before it was a black man's bones being melted into a black man's bones, who was somewhat, though I had it memorized, that makes it intimate, somewhat removed from me. It was no longer removed from me. I was the guy into whose bones black bones were absorbed. And I was the guy into whom the gray ashes formed flesh firm and black. I don't think that's a presumptuous statement. As a white man, I would never claim to be able to experience the American black experience. But as a man, or a human being, I would claim to be able to experience the suffering of another that somehow gets past. And so that poem changed for me in that way. Is that an answer?
Yeah, it's beyond black.
Well, okay, you got that. You listen to this poem or follow along too with the same kind of feelings. And let your imagination go as you hear this. And these images are just going to blast out at you. I mean, they're going to explode as you see all these little things. And let these images evoke in you whatever they will evoke. What image does a whore's lipstick? I mean, what is he trying to do? Kind of sensationalize this and make this a, ooh, this is kind of a racy poem, let's read it? No way. What does the whore's lipstick on the ground there evoke in you? And the way I will read, but then the way I read is automatically a kind of interpretation that may not be your interpretation, but the way I read or the way you think about peanut shells. What do you think of when that image comes up that you're looking at this and here's a guy who's been tortured and then there's peanut shells out there in the grass? And then if you didn't hear it, because I introduced it that night, this is a common experience as late as 1947, 10 blacks, I mean, most of us were alive in 1947, 10 blacks were lynched as far north as the state of Kansas. And the lynching that this guy, that Wright refers to, is also common. First, there was castration. And parts of the body, I mean, it's an unbelievably Nazi-est kind of thing. Parts of the body were saved. Richard Wright has a story, Big Boy Leaves Home, where one of the characters is watching a lynching and one of the white guys out watching, I want a souvenir! And that's how, think of that and then think of peanut shells. Okay, here we go. Peanut shells. And one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. Stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms. And the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bones slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, and a scorched coil of greasy hemp. A vacant shoe, an empty tie, a ripped shirt a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass were buttons, dead matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, a drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet, and my heart was circled by icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky. A night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled the leaves and the trees. The woods poured forth the hungry yelping of hounds. The darkness screamed with thirsty voices, and the witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The whore smeared the lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling. And my skin clung to the bubbling hot tar, falling from me in limp patches. And the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. And my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline, and in a blaze of red I leaped to the sky as pain rose like water, boiling my limbs. Panting, begging, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death. Now, I am dry bones, and my face, a stony skull staring in yellow surprise at the sun. Wright might be a better poet than he is novelist. He's not, because he wrote more novels. Just any kind of response at all. I heard this from several people Monday. I needed time after that one. You need time to, not intellectually, but emotionally process.
Well, this is the third time I've heard this one this week. And it's no less powerful, it's more powerful every time. I didn't mean that to say, don't do it.
I understand, I appreciate it.
I can understand the feeling of suddenly being transformed. As you said, we can never feel that we've had this experience. But the empathy grows.
I'm right, I'm listening.
That's all.
It's yeah, just, good. Thank you.
The more you experience it, the more the empathy grows.
And that's reinforcement for memorization. You go over it, you go over it, you go over it. I've performed this poem probably 100 times, and I am never not just swept away. Never.
When I was out, there was a hanging in the University of Idaho, and at first it said that the person was black, and the person's hands were tied behind their back, and I felt some of this same stuff, you know, all the images of lynching, because my parents had told me about. You know, when they grew up hearing about lynchings, and my grandmother actually told me she witnessed one and that kind of thing. And all of these kind of images came up. And then later, it said that the guy was Iranian. But, and they said he left a suicide note, but it didn't make sense. It was suicide. Why he would tie his hands behind his back? So it's kind of shady still. But the fact that he was Iranian didn't really take it away, not totally. The idea that a group of human beings
would hang another human being to watch.
Yeah.
So those feelings came up when I, and I thought of this poem because I think you...
The position is chaotic. And I was thinking that, I had heard this poem before, and then in the second half it's all very orderly. And it's interesting that he does it that way, and it gives you sort of two feelings of horror. The first one is horrific because it's all mixed up. And here you come upon the scene and it's just a mess. And the body is a mess. So that it's almost impossible to realize that it's a body. Although the dry bones stuff to me evokes Ezekiel. So that there's that possibility of, you know, things coming back together. But then the second half is so meticulous in taking it all apart. So that even the order is destructive.
Yep. The deliberateness of the act. That's very good.
Yeah. Ezekiel came to me this time too, and so this is one of the things I want to pursue. What I was thinking about is how in this poem,
Wright, by the way, knows the Bible.
Yeah.
So
the speaker becomes part, of the vision. We can call it a vision, like Ezekiel's. In Ezekiel, the speaker becomes an active part of the vision by being asked to call the Spirit forth to bring these to life. And here, the speaker is a passive part. It's all happening to him. It's sort of overwhelming him. He's out of control of the experience. A couple other things that I want to say this so I can remember them because I don't have them to write down. A couple of things I want to pursue is the irony. The other night, the gasoline, the irony of that baptism of gasoline or the soothing struck me. And what I heard in it this time was the cushion of ashes, which sort of prepares for that further irony. I want to trace some of that. And the other thing I'd like to pursue when I get a copy is the vacant shoe. Now I use the word vacant, I very seldom use it for anything as personal or as small, thank you, as an article of clothing. I usually think of a vacant lot or a vacant building.
Yep, yep.
So what that was doing for me is sort of acting like a funnel, bringing the large down into the smaller detail and trying to encompass a lot into these small details.
Good. Thank you. Great. Kel.
This time, how it began with kind of an introduction or an outline, and then the detail becomes later. It's almost like a novel and how he gives all of the explanations. The other part was almost a contrast and describing the inhumanity of a crowd, and then he goes into the humanity of the person.
Yeah, good. The inhumanity of the crowd. Peanut shell. They're drinking gin, and passing around peanut shells. And can you imagine wiping lipstick on while this is going on? But she's a whore. And the cat, you get it. Yeah, good. Thank you.
Well, in connection with that, even though you get kind of a more narrative description of the white, and there's a real emptiness in the words, vacant shoe, empty tie, and yet it's the black man that's present with us.
Yep.
And the good. Emptiness of the white people.
Yeah. No, you guys are great. You're in. Pally.
I was grabbed with the power of the trousers stiff with black blood. And the double nature of the black blood, I could so much see this black, hardened, crusted blood on these pants, and then
but it's black, also black blood.
Blood, yeah.
And you don't have to raise your hand on this, it's not that kind of question. But the black blood, and there are white and black in this room, becomes yours, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I mean, and that's part of the power of this, that we, as we become this person, the blood and blood brothers, sisters, the blood evoke the blood, the flesh, the bones. It's all part. And Wright doesn't get credit for being a great poet. And I give him credit, well, though, by golly.
Well, I think.
Fight it over. Who's? I don't care.
Well, I think in the first half, when it's dismembered remains, that all the cultural things that go along with who we are as separate people belonging to different groups break down.
Yep.
Because of skull. Skull is a skull.
What's cultural in this whole thing? I mean, the human being is reduced to blood and flesh and bones and then finally, as you put it all together, is reduced to the spirit of a human being. There's anything about any cultural reference, is there at all? It's connectedness with other people. Yeah.
I was going to ask what it intrigues me, but between the world and me, for a title, mm-hmm. I don't know what that means exactly. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, I can guess, but maybe it'll be more fun to have you guys. You know, that's some people say that's good teaching. I say it's cop-out teaching, and I do it all the time. What do you think of that? Any question I can't answer, what do you think? But I have an answer to that. But.
Well, the world is all the paradigms that he walked upon this scene with.
Yes.
In my opinion.
Yep.
So, all
which
of
are?
A sudden,
give a couple.
You get the, well, which are, it's okay to torture and kill black people.
Yep.
I'm a white person, this will not touch me emotionally, physically, or any other way. You go through the lines here, and he's observing things all the way down until, and while I stood, my mind was frozen. And all of a sudden, this came between this paradigm and himself.
Yeah, well, even on the board here, and what it says up here, for those of you who are too far away to see it, success, money, house, health and fitness, law, certainty, absolutes, religion, food, clothes, that's the world. And suddenly something's come between that and me. And isn't it the sensitivity of becoming, not just relating to, but of becoming someone else. Well, we can, let's move, well, go ahead. I don't want to cut anybody off, but at the same time, whatever, it's your choice.
Lynchings are something that are done in secret primarily, so it's like the real reality that comes up from underneath all the things that are visible.
Makes sense too, yeah. This is the real reality coming, yeah, good.
Were they done in secret?
Well,
I was thinking about what a ritual this was, you know, the deliberateness of it all, you know, but you, when the poem was being read, you know, I was seeing, you know, the men meeting, you know, how much work would, you know, who's got the tar? I mean, how much work it would take to boil tar?
The answer was deliberateness, yeah.
To you got the gasoline, you got this, you got that. You know, nothing secret about it. You know, I mean, they would be meeting at someone's bar, I'd see these men meeting behind someone's garage, getting everything together. You know, this is a town thing.
Yep.
And that's, I was thinking, that's the world.
Yep. And I think that's in secret in the sense that it's out in the woods maybe someplace, but everybody knows. And come on, we're going to bring our kids and... You can see photographs, Life magazine has them, of fathers standing with their kids on the shoulders, watching a lynching.
But they were officially secret. I mean, yeah, the Lonzas, yeah. were they secret?
From the
culture. Well, you go to the town, whoever, gendarmes, and no, this doesn't happen in our community.
Right.
Whereas at night, he may put on his hood and go.
Yeah.
It's sort of wondering.
Yes.
Balcony turn.
Well, I was just going to say, you sort of wonder whether they're officially secret. They're sanctioned in a certain sense. Law enforcement certainly knew what was happening.
Yes.
The other thing, when you talked about the whore's lipstick, came up much more strongly to me this time. And just thinking of the irony of the violence is varying levels.
Yes. Good. Yeah.
I didn't understand.
Well, there's violence that's done at many, many levels. The organization of lynching, but that you have a whore there, that's another violence that's done to another group of people at any one time. And to make that part of the party, so to speak,
yeah.
Which is clearly the atmosphere.
Yeah.
First thing that comes to my mind with peanut shells is a circus.
Yep. Yep.
Where else do you have peanut shells except at a bar or a circus?
I was in Carnival and Mardi Gras. Sort of, I mean, sort of ritualistic.
This is a happening, sure.
However, my sense of the horse lipstick, I don't think was this. I mean, my sense was that she was just, she was there.
Well, but that's, as a woman, my invoking of the empathy that happens there is the violence against women.
She was a sideshow.
Yeah.
I've always thought that even lipstick was a kind of violence. I mean, I got to get made up just right and deep.
But they were all there.
But
they were all there to a certain extent. If it's happening to this poor black man, it's one less time it will happen to you. You know, if you're a whore, you know, the focus is not on you,
well,
your moral standing
in
the community.
Yeah.
It's focused on this poor black man. If you're a poor farmer who can't make a good living, and you know everyone knows you're a drunkard or a bum or whatever, for this one instance, it's focused on this other poor, miserable person who's worse.
That's very good. And this just shows you what you can do with poetry, and you make me, I'm not going to talk about this at any length at all, but Wright was a student of Dostoevsky. He studied his stuff. They weren't contemporaries or anything like that. He studied his stuff, and Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor is about when Jesus comes back to the earth and is going to get hung up and killed again, who's there? Everybody comes. The ladies of Seville, the kings, the queens, the court, the church, and all the common people. He lists them very carefully, are going to come and watch Jesus die again. They're going to string him up again. And he makes it a point that everybody participates so we can just focus on this other and away from. That just reminds me of that. And all I say that for is it gives you an idea of how far you can take poetry once it evokes these feelings and then your intellect starts to spin and lots of things get going. And ultimately then the spirit has changed. And I mean your spirit, our spirit. Right, one more, then let's move on after that. I don't want to, okay. Sure.
Well, just a response. First time I heard that, the reading, I felt like I was kicked in the stomach.
You felt like what?
I was kicked in the stomach.
Yeah.
It was so evil, and so horrible, and so terrible. And I found, just listening to it being read again, I felt I'd had that experience and didn't want to go there, so I did something else with it. And I thought, what if at the very end? I was wondering at the very end if the writer could have said, what would have happened if he said at the very end, probably forgiveness? Would that have been even possible?
And that's a fun idea, or a meaningful idea to deal with. And that makes it another poem. And I can see why you do that. This is hard to. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
I'd like to say this. In terms of the title, Between the World and Me, it made me think that, listening to the poet, that how could one live in a world where that can happen to someone, anybody, and it does make the world different already.
It's a great point, and it's the whole world. I have been, for lots of complicated reasons that I see, a student of the literature of the oppressed, and I've read also a lot of stuff by survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. And one of the things I've read in that is the autobiography of Rudolf Hess, the head of Auschwitz. And it's so disturbing on one level, unnerving on the other, and unthinkable on the bottom level, is that there'd be these guys sitting around a table. This reinforces your idea of how deliberate this whole thing is. Somebody had to say, who's got the gasoline? Who's bringing the tar? You got the rope? I mean, they had to do that stuff. And here's Rudolf Hess sitting around the table with about four other people and saying, you know, carbon monoxide doesn't work efficiently enough. Let's try Zyklon B. Oh, that's that stuff we're using for, yeah, let's put that in if we can pump and we can rebuild. And you know, Mr. Engineer, we're not burning efficiently enough. We've got to have a newly designed furnace. This is how those guys talked around the table. Because we can only burn 600 bodies a day, and we've got to up that number to 900. Between the world and me. It's so unthinkably evil.
Did he ever go to church?
Hess?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think so, though. My guess is he did.
Probably. If you read John Bradshaw, he's got this whole theory about how the German Nazis were the most religious of all because they, number one, they could excuse it, and number two, they were so used to letting the authority tell them what to do without questioning.
There's Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor.
Yeah.
But this happens on all levels. I mean, think of the Iran-Contra.
Yes.
I mean, there are people sitting around saying, should we get this disturbance going in Latin America, you know, so we can get more money for this and get people pumped up for that.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of stuff is going on.
Shall we start a war in Iraq so people can pay attention to the savings of all things?
Yeah.
The question to be asking is what will generations in the future be saying when they look back on the atrocities that are happening right now?
They won't believe that we've turned aside.
How could they let it happen?
Well, they're probably still committing their own.
Yeah.
Robert had something.
I just remember along the thoughts of Between the World and Me, the poem provides something for me to look through at the world. And as Verlaine says, that's what the world is like. We sit around talking about how horrible this is. And the Holocaust was secret. There was the same secrecy in the Holocaust, and there is the same secrecy. We are very well aware of what is going on in Iraq at the moment because of what we did and are doing in the future.
And doesn't it all, you just very good, make mockery of the whole concept of secrecy, like the Germans didn't know that they're, you know, the body smells come drifting over the cities. And what's going on back there?
Well, that the title really strikes me as an indication of a sort of awakening, that it's so easy for most of us, if we're at all successful, to think that the world is something that it's not until we have an experience that makes us realize that it's not. And then sort of drives a wedge. And for me, that was starting
then
to
it's not successful.
Yeah,
the world.
Starting to work with battered women, that my life has been very fortunate in many ways. You know, I fit in. I've been at the right places at the right time. But then to see what happened to these women, not because I was better, but because I was luckier, is this kind of an experience where you suddenly realize I'm not successful. Or if I am, it's a fluke. So it drives, and I don't know how that would fit into Wright's biography. But that experience of oppressed people, of sometimes having the illusion that they fit in. And then you go, oh, no, it's an illusion.
Thank you.
The notion of, again, Between the World and Me also takes me back to the images in very blatant wedge between you and the possibilities of the world.
Yeah.
But there are lots of other
wedges. Yeah. Very good. The dream deferred. We're not just deferring this dream. We're going to whack it off right at that. But look at the other ones too. Yeah. Thank you.
And part of the power for me was the tackling woods and the charred sapling that suffers because of what, you know, humanity's imperfection.
Yeah.
What humanity's doing, you know, what we do to each other, we do to the world.
The charred sapling, the innocent charred sapling.
Oil well burning.
Yeah. Too. Yeah, that's good. And you know, you can sit there, and we're all adults, and we're past the stage of playing games in the classroom, and say, where did you get all that? Can you read? You're reading that into the poem. No way. The poem evokes that feeling, and whether Wright deliberately had that in mind or not, I suspect he didn't. We've all been in these kinds of conversations where we've said, do you realize what you just said? And where have you been speaking from when someone responds that way? Your subconscious, your unconsciousness, that's as much a part of our reality as is our consciousness, sometimes more a part of our reality. So out of this subconscious unconsciousness that you have and that right had, it all gets put there. And yeah, innocent things, in this case, that's a great comment. And it illustrates something about the power of poetry, good poetry, to expand beyond its own kind of parameters that we want to impose on it. English teachers do anything. Thank you for that. It's great. We don't have to go on. It's your show, but we do have. I don't know if we do or not. Was anybody here when we did this poem, "Black Art" by Imamu Amiri Baraka? It's called. It's got scratch in the Baraka Black Art. Very quickly, we have to do this. Don't read it ahead, because this is a special kind of poem. What does Jesus? I was going to write it on the board, but I won't do it now. What does Jesus say about success?
First should be last, actually first.
That's a great one. Anything else? Good.
What good is it to gain the whole world and lose your soul?
Great. Gain the whole world, but you lose your soul? Good. Keep going. What does he say about money? Huh? Root of evil. Okay, good.
Render unto Caesar.
Okay, give it to Caesar. Okay?
You cannot serve God in mammon.
You can't serve God in. Okay, good. What does he say about houses?
Build your house on a rock.
Okay, build it on a rock. What does he say about owning houses?
The only with sandals.
Okay. About the lilies of the field and all that stuff. Don't worry about shelf. Okay. Health and fitness. I wouldn't say I'm a health nut, but I like to stay physically fit so I can keep up with Rudy on the hikes and back to the donkey. We're fitness guys. Which of you can add to your own life? He asks it. Law, certainty, absolutes. In my opinion, as I look at the New Testament, that's Jesus everywhere. He just crashes down on all the absolutes. Hey, we caught this woman in adultery. What do they do to her? You throw the first stone. And I know this passage, I came to fulfill the law and so on. But he goes away with a lot of certainties. Read, especially Matthew, is it 4, the temptation scene? You know, jump off the cliff. Get behind me. He, I'm not going to suck people in by proving and so on. What does he say about religion? Practice it, you know, somewhere else. What does he say about food? That lilies of the valley, Pharaoh's clothes, same kind of thing. I just do that very quickly to say, I think, between the world, when Jesus looks at the world, he has a very radical vision about what pulls us in and gives us meaning, right? And typically, it's this stuff we spend our energy going after. Richard Wright said, and I'm done with Wright after this, in some of his nonfiction, if it weren't for black people, no one would ever ask a question about democracy. Because we are threatened with our democracy, and we're going to keep pushing for what the whole idea is. And everyone, says Wright, benefits from our questions. Well, Imamu Amiri Baraka, this black art poem, and before you read it, I'm going to sort of apologize and sort of try to explain. There's a lot of very rough language in this poem. It's not a poem I walk around quoting. It's not a poem that I would read in church. I would read it to an adult education class, however. I mean, the language is rough, and I know that. I'll tell you something about Baraka. He is clearly one of the leading intellectuals in America. He won an Obie Off-Broadway Award for a play he wrote called The Dutchman. He's published tons of poetry. Not only is he an artist, the playwright, and the poet, he is also a great scholar on black spirituals and black folklore, and he's done all kinds of homework on that. He's an academic teacher in a college. That is no credential, but he's done his stuff, and he is an academician. And as I read him, just trust me, I think he's clearly one of the leading intellects in America, social analyzer and so on. Okay, so when he uses these words, he's not being some dummy. He's got a lot of things in mind. I would have to say I would read this in church. I don't know if I'd ever read it to my mother. Okay. Just, where was it? I'm going to stop with about 10 lines to go, and when I stop, don't you read on. Poems are bullshit unless they are teeth or trees or lemons piled on a step or black ladies dying of men leaving nickel hearts beating them down. fuck poems in there useful. Would they shoot come at you, love what you are, breathe like wrestlers, or shudder strangely after pissing? We want live words of the hip world, live flesh and coursing blood, hearts, brains, souls splintering fire. We want poems like fists beating niggers out of jocks, or dagger poems in the slimy bellies of the owner Jews, black poems to smear on girdle mama mulatto bitches whose brains are red jelly stuck between Elizabeth Taylor's toes. Stinking whores, we want poems that kill. Assassin poems, poems that shoot guns, poems that wrestle cops into alleys. I mean, the whole L.A. scene that we all just saw is his prophecy almost there. And take their weapons, leaving them dead with tongues pulled out and sent to Ireland. Knockoff poems for dope-selling wops or slick half-white politicians. Airplane poems, setting fire and death to Whitey's ass. Look at the liberal. Spokesman for the Jews clutch his throat and puke himself into eternity. There's a Negro leader pinned to a bar stool in Sardis, eyeballs melting in hot flame. Another Negro leader on the steps of the White House, one kneeling between the sheriff's thighs, negotiating coolly for his people. Ah! Stumbles across the room. Put it on him, poem. Strip him naked to the world. Another bad poem cracking steel knuckles in a Jew lady's mouth. Don't read on. How do you feel?
Scared.
Scared. Be honest, how do you feel?
Repelled.
Huh?
Repelled.
It is, it's repelling stuff. Now, why does a guy that's such a leading intellect resort to this stuff? Don't answer that either. I just want to keep going. How do you feel?
Angry.
Angry. Afraid, repelled, angry. Disgusted. My mother would say, aren't there another poem you can read that does the same thing? keep angry, repelled, disgusted.
Confused.
Overwhelmed. Keep going. Your guts.
A little bit defensive.
Okay, and it's right. We're defensive about it. Come on, this is too strong.
Yeah.
Look at all this stuff. Sell all you have. Well, wait a minute. I mean, I got a lot of stuff, Jesus. I know. Sell all you have, give it to the poor. I mean, you know that stuff. Love me more than your brother and mother, and all those radical statements you can think of that he says. Well, wait a minute, we get defensive with Jesus too. They got so defensive, string him up. We can't take this guy. Keep going. How do you feel?
Empathy.
That's pretty interesting. Empathy. To explain that.
Well, there's a lot of stuff here that really makes you churn, and you realize that's a reality for people. He's pissed off, and it's. You know people, or you've had some bad experience yourself with authority and junk like that, it can really make you...
Very good. Very good. We won't have time. If you're interested, otherwise told away. I can see why some people wouldn't be interested. What I want to illustrate to you, black art, this is modern, this is 1967 or so, comes at us and radically views the world to give us a new vision of what can be. Now, listen to the end. And note also how you feel. Poems scream poison gas on beasts and green berets. Clean out the world for virtue and love. Let there be no love poems written until love can exist freely and cleanly. Let black people understand that they are the lovers and the sons of lovers, and warriors and sons of warriors are poems and poets and all the loveliness here in the world. Even that, you know, I understand this. The connotation is perhaps sexist. The connotation of the word loveliness is feminine. Ask William Blake. Loveliness. And we've come after, we've got this word loveliness in there after all that radical, angry stuff. But black people understand that they are the lovers. And the sons of lovers, and warriors and sons of warriors are poems and poets. And all the loveliness here in the world, we want a black poem and a black world. Let the world be a black poem and let all black people speak this poem silently or loud. I'm just suggesting to you, that's a voice for all of us, the title of the session. A voice of radically looking at a world that could be different from Elizabeth Taylor stuck between your toes. And that's a reference, I think, to the idea of beauty. You know, if I don't look like Elizabeth Taylor, I'm ugly, or et cetera, et cetera. That's not to compare it with this, but it's to set up an awareness of this kind of radical vision of the world that says, look at all that stuff and now see what is your soul gain if you gain the whole world. The black artist is challenging us to the same thing, I think. I'll stop. We've got about 1 minute to answer it. To talk.
Is he saying do this through poetry? Poems that kill.
The poems kill, that's right. And it just did, didn't it? That's why I asked that question. Jeez, I don't want to do this.
I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying, at the beginning, he says, we want poems to do this, but stop and think. You know, as I'm starting to see this, I'm changing my mind. I'm saying, but there can be no love poems.
The bell will ring, so if he wants to take off, go ahead, and then we'll just keep talking too. So, you're great.